This is The Cool Kitchen on Rock Access Radio, Magic Monster Radio, KCLA 99.3 FM in Los Angeles, DCRC Radio 1, 1075, and How.fm in New Zealand. OnAirTunes.com presents PrimalRadioLive.com and The Indie Authority. I'm Ola, and I have a really special show here. Cherry Red is releasing a compilation called The Dawn of Creation Records from 1983 to 1985, various artists. And this is going out on September 25th, 2015. And it's the first comprehensive box set devoted to the early years of creation. And you can purchase this at shop.cherryred.co.uk. Now, in lieu of this, I will be speaking to some of the artists that were there in the beginning. And I'm thrilled to be having a chat in the show with Phil King. And this ties back to the first track that I played as well. Phil was an original member of The Servants, The Fabulous Servants. And the song, the first song that I played there was from 1986, The Servants, and that's called The Sun, A Small Star. Now, Phil will be talking about how The Servants led him to working with early creation artists such as Biff Bang Pow, Felt, and later the Jesus and Mary Chain. And as well as that, he's also talking about his time in Lush. So that's really, really exciting. Basically, the early artists of creation would go on to spawn loads of truly great indie music throughout the 80s and the 90s. It's all kind of connected. And it's fabulous to talk to Phil about these great bands. Now, I'd like to thank Kelly Pope for making this possible, and she also runs all of the official Creation Records social media. So if you want to keep up on all of the latest from the creation bands and what they're doing now, There is a Facebook and a Twitter that's on Creation Records, and there's a YouTube, and on the Mixcloud, I believe it's called Creation Records UK. Okay, on to my chat with Phil King. Okay, I'm Ola, and I'm so excited because I have a fantastic guest. This is Phil King, who's been in quite an array of amazing bands, which he's here to talk about with me.
Pleasure to be here.
And it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
First proper band that you were in was The Servants.
It was about 85, 86. I guess like most bands in London, sort of joined through the small ads in, well, I think it was in The Enemy, actually. It was either Enemy or Melody Maker, based in Hayes, David Westlake and John Mohan. We were a bedroom band for a while.
Bedroom? What do you mean by bedroom?
We just rehearsed in the bedroom.
Oh, right, okay.
With a drum machine. And then we got a drummer. And then we started playing around London. First show was supporting the television personality. So we supported them. Jasmine Minx, we used to play at the Enterprise.
Creation Records band.
Because Dan Tracy from TVP's had a club called Room at the Top at the Enterprise. So we used to play there a lot, supporting Mighty Lemon Drops and groups like that. Then Jeff Barrett, now of Heavenly, he was doing press for Creation. He was just starting a label called Head with Bill Prince from the Wishing Stones, and came to see us and signed us and managed us. And because of his connections, we got support slots with all the cool Creation bands: Felt, Primal Scream, The Weather Prophets.
That's how you can.
Jesus and Mary Chain.
Yeah.
Well, a few years later, when I was playing with Alan, he said, I'd given him a demo tape, and he said, oh, I wanted to sign you to Creation. But he rang up the number, but I don't think he got any reply.
Okay, so let me get this straight. You had a demo tape that you sent as
to Alan McGee
when you were in the Servants.
Yeah.
And you didn't sign the Servants because the phone didn't work.
Phone didn't.
Okay,
work.
Yeah, that's definitely the phone number didn't work. Oh, so a bit of a.
Whereas someone else called. I remember Dan Tracy's girlfriend Emily, who was the singer in The Henry's Beautiful Daughters, and used to do the Room at the Top. She rang up the number, which was my home number. I lived at home with my dad. And my dad didn't know that I was in a group called The Servants and answered the phone. And she said, can I speak to one of the servants? And he said, sorry, we haven't got any servants here.
Oh, no. Okay.
And then after just going, why a stupid name like The Servants?
I would actually ask about the Servants sound, because it's very English. And it has this art school rock feel to it.
But yeah.
I played a Servant song on my show. Is there a connection to the Go-Betweens and what that is?
Well, when we named ourselves, because David was a huge Go-Betweens fan, the singer and songwriter. I was a huge Felt fan. Oh, and Dirk Bogarde. So the Go-Betweens, of course, is a Joseph Losey film.
Yes, I've seen it.
And The Servant is a Joseph Losey film with Dirk Bogarde in it.
Okay.
So we named ourselves The Servants.
Oh, so...
And it was mentioned, I think we'd our first Enemy our only Enemy interview with Bill Prince, actually, in the New Year issue, I think 86 of The Enemy. It mentions my unrequited passion for Felt, which Lawrence saw, and David's for the Go-Betweens. And we ended up supporting the Go-Betweens on their Liberty Bell tour in 86. And we even ended up using the same producer for The Son of Small Star, who produced their album.
Because when I played the song, I could hear some sort of influence of the Go-Betweens, whether the track that I could hear that kind of haunted 80s indie.
Yeah.
I can't really explain the sound very well, but it's got that kind of...
Uptight.
Uptight? How? I never thought of it as uptight.
Well, I think it's quite uptight. It's kind of quite insular and...
Oh,
but
okay.
Melodic. And then The Servants split up around the time of The Son of Small Star, just before it came out. And
that was 86?
That was 86.
Yeah.
Lawrence called me, and then he did the bass player. He was always into hair, and he thought I had good hair. So that helped.
He really liked your hair.
He liked my
hair.
Oh,
bless.
Well, my hair got me placed. That's why
your hair got you placed. Oh, brilliant!
That's why I was in the Primal Scream Gentle Tuesday video, because I had a pudding bowl. Dave Morgan from the Weather Prophets actually played on it, but he didn't have the right hair.
Oh.
And Robert Forster from the Go Betweens always used to compliment me. He used to ask me what shampoo I use and conditioner.
I love the Go Betweens. So that is a great little thing to know, that Robert Forster asked you what your shampoo was. Oh, that's fantastic. Okay, so future rocker and rollers out there, take care of your hair because it can get you places.
Yeah, it's very important hair. So I joined Felt, as I say, and Felt kind of got me through the early part of the up until the mid 80s really,
in terms of work or
no, just in terms of music. Post-punk was great, but was quite often lacking tunes, whereas, you know, Felt was so melodic,
mm-hmm.
and beautiful, yeah. and enigmatic,
yeah.
And so for me it was like a dream come true playing with Felt. And I went to the office and they gave me a white label of, you know, Forever Breathes a Lonely Word, and I just thought, wow, they're going to be huge. But of course they weren't.
See, this is an interesting thing, because you have all these sounds and like shoegaze and all this stuff, and Lush was a big part of it, which we'll get to later, but Felt is like this quiet younger brother or sister, like, you know, before that sometimes gets overlooked, although they were, I think they were quite, you know, very influential in,
well, I think it's
this
thing, like, it's not like Brian Eno says about the Velvet Underground, everyone who bought the Velvet's first album formed a band, or especially in the 80s, I think a lot of people, all musicians, well, especially from the Croatian scene, were all into Felt, you know, because
yeah.
there were so few fantastic guitar bands around, melodic guitar bands.
They missed the time for their...
Definitely.
You know what I mean?
And I think also maybe being on Cherry Red as well, because, you know, I always thought, wow, they're so enigmatic. Then you realise it was partly because Cherry Red probably didn't want to spend any money on promoting them, you know. So, but it kind of helped them be more mysterious. So I joined them, and then, yeah, I toured with them, and around the time of Poem Over River as well, the next album. There's Creation tours around Europe. I mean, they were on such a tight budget that Lawrence and I used to have to share a double bed, like Morecambe and Wise style.
Oh man, yeah. Oh. It's been said that Lawrence was a demanding boss in Felt. Would you say that's true?
Well, he's got very fixed ideas on mm-hmm. how things should be done.
Mm-hmm.
I guess you could say he's sort of quietly dictatorial. He's not overbearing with it. He knows what he wants.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of artists are like that, you know. They yeah. have to have some kind of, I mean, some people are more fluid,
a lot of it
with
is,
vision.
A lot of it, not so much about the music, actually. It's more aesthetic. Say, for example, after I finished and Felt, John Moen, who was a guitarist in The Servants, joined them. And he was going to wear some trainers on stage one night, and Lawrence said, no, it's not allowed, you've got to wear shoes.
It's very important about the image he's portraying.
The image, yeah, very important. You know, especially he would never hire anyone that's got curly hair, because the first drummer got sacked, I think, because he had curly hair.
And he had a fixed notion that curly hair is... So.
In fact, I remember I was with him once, and he asked Malcolm McLaren, what about Steve Jones's curly hair? And he had to agree it was wrong. He said that's why he wore a hanky on his head at one point, to cover up his curly hair.
So again, it's down to the hair, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
You'll find a common theme mm-hmm. here going on.
And whereas Lawrence, because unfortunately he used to draw attention to the fact he was losing his hair, he'd always sort of go, look at my hairline, or he'd say, why don't you ever talk about your dad, Lawrence? And he'd go, because he's bald, the bastard.
Is his what? Sorry?
He's bald.
Oh, okay.
So.
What do you think the impact of Felt was on other Croatian artists as well? Do you think?
Oh, very strong. I mean, say, for example, when they joined, they were doing shows with Primal Scream and the Weather Look packages. And Lawrence used to... there was Splash One happening, which was... Bobby's was involved in the club up in Glasgow early on. And, you know, Felt would play... And as I say, they were one of the few cool, melodic guitar bands around, you know.
Okay, and then from there, you joined Alan McGee's band.
Biff Bang Pow.
Biff Bang Pow, yeah.
Around the Love Is Forever album. Because what happened was Dave Evans was a bass player in Biff Bang Pow. He left because he was working with Jesus Mary Chain and played guitar for them shortly. And then around the same time, I took a demo I'd recorded into Creation. And they didn't have a stereo in Creation, obviously. They had an answer machine, so they would put the cassette in the answer machine. And I played this song, which they liked, so they put me in the studio. They used to have a deal with Alaska Studios in Waterloo. Like Mary Chain recorded their first single there and just put me in for the weekend, and it came out as Apple Boutique in 88.
I mean, this was Alan's singing on this.
On Biff Bang Pow.
Yeah.
And he wrote the songs as well.
And I mean,
they were good. They're really good, actually. Well, I think initially before Biff Bang Pow, I had a group, The Laughing Apple. And I think even when he started his The Living Room, I think maybe, I don't know if part of that was because, you know, it was somewhere to put. Did that Biff Bang Pow? Did they actually ever play The Living Room? I'm not sure. I mean, there was that sort of 60s aesthetic as well. And also when I was in The Servants, you know, it was the 80s in London. They were from Hayes, which was, it was lots of, you know, you'd get off the train and there'd be the Nestle factory, and there'd be like, when there was a low cloud, there was just the smell of coffee and it was grey, and you know, you'd go around to David's and he'd have the Love album or the Birds, and you'd be looking at going, wow.
Colour,
blue skies, great hair, melodic songs, you know, and it was just, it felt like we were starved of it. And that was only, at that time, you know, that was 20 years before, which seemed like a long time. For us, it was very rejuvenating listening to that and music and looking at the imagery as well.
And yeah, there's a definite 60s feeling to quite a bit of Creation, I think. You know, that,
especially early on. Well, even Oasis, I guess, you know, Beatles.
Yeah,
you know.
It's very, I mean, Alan loves the Beatles.
They're more Stone Roses influence. Sex Pistols, you know.
I get what you're saying, because I imagine that England in the 80s was kind of grim, industrial.
Miners' strike, you know, well, not the miners' strike, but, you know, the police presence, and it was, you know, Margaret Thatcher, and, yeah, it was pretty grim. Musically, it was grim as well. It was all emulator keyboards and Live Aid, and I like synth music.
I do, too.
But they have, at that time, they had the ability to make synth music sound boring. And I remember there being a documentary on Peter Gabriel, his studio in Bath, and he was saying, yeah, you can smash bottles and sample it. And you think, wow, that's amazing. And he does it, and it just made it, the sound of a smashing bottle sound really boring. Talking about smashing bottles, I remember in 98 we went into the studio, did a BBC session with the Mary Chain, and the guy who engineered or produced it was very friendly, and Jim was like, it wasn't that friendly in 1985 when we wanted to smash a bottle and record it.
So maybe the smashing of bottles wasn't always acceptable in this studio. Here's a good question I'd like to ask about Alan, because, you know, you obviously know him from the band, as a singer, and you know him through the record label, and you know him for the years. What's your favorite thing?
My favorite thing is he's very driven. His enthusiasm, you know, he's very, very positive, very enthusiastic. You know, not having seen him for years and then meeting him again recently, and the first thing you are struck by is, you know, how much energy he's got, how positive and enthusiastic he is, you know.
I didn't know that I could.
It's my reality. It's my reality. It's my reality. It's my reality. Yeah.
Had a bit of a musical break, and that was Biff Bang Pow. And the track was from 1988, She Haunts. Now, for any London listeners out there, The Cool Kitchen will be DJing on Saturday, September 19th, 2015. This is at the Amersham Arms at 388 New Cross Road, SE14. And it's free entry. It's going to be in the front of the pub, and it's going to be fun-filled 80s electro and alternative and nostalgic 90s indie until the wee hours of 3 a.m. So drop in for a pint and some fine musical selections. Now let's join the chat with Phil King as he discusses Lush.
So I was Lush from 91. We toured 92. So Spooky came out in 92, so I toured it. So we played over 120 shows. A couple of we did our own American tour. We did Lollapalooza, which is 2 months.
So tell me, the story is how you joined Lush, because I read about it. It's like you ended up going, you met Mickey, I think it was, for a drink?
I had a mutual friend, Polly, who knew them, and you're looking for a bass player. I went to the Good Mixer.
The Good Mixer, yeah.
For a drink with Mickey and Chris, the drummer. I've never really auditioned. It's more just being, people can know that I can play, and just, you know, meet up, and, you know, because you spend so much time with other members of the group, you've got to be able to get on. So I just met up with them, and it was just about whether we got on or not, and I guess we did, because they asked me to join. So I work at the moment at Uncut, at the music magazine. You get in the lift and you hear people complaining about someone in their office, and you just think, my God, you only spend 7 hours a day with them. You know, you're in a group. You spend 16 or longer waking hours with them, cooped up in a tour bus or a backstage or in the studio or being interviewed. You know, you spend all your time in each other's pockets, so you have to be able to get on. You know, added to that, drink and maybe drugs or whatever, and egos. So, you know, it's, you know, a lot of people say about groups, I get surprised when groups split up, and I'm more often surprised groups last so long.
Because there's all these pressures.
And pressures from the record company, you know. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? When you're in a group, it can just all end like that.
Yeah, it's got this very ephemeral nature.
You don't even get, you know, at least you're in a day job, you get a month's notice.
Yeah.
There's no, could be no notice, you know, it could be, it's like, it could be all over like that in a flash.
Yeah, absolutely. So they were very much part of the shoegaze feeling, you know, and it was a very short scene. It only lasted like a few years, but they were like very important to it. And then as it was kind of, and then it just started to fade.
I guess the end of shoegazing was probably Chapter House at Reading, when they went on after Nirvana. I think that was probably.
Oh my God. Oh, I love Chapter House, but that was a bad way to... You can't...
When would that be? That 93, I think that was?
Oh, that's so sad. I mean, I like Chapter House. I really do. What did you think of Lush's sound before you joined? Were you a fan?
I saw them supporting Felt, House and Love. Remember, I saw them at the Sausage...
It's a Sausage Machine. Yeah.
That was an early show. That was actually supporting this group, Mexico 70.
I mean, was that like at the White Horse or was that
at the White Horse?
Yeah.
All I remember is lots of giggling in between the song. Before the shoegazing turn, they were almost quite post-punky, really.
Mm-hmm. Why was there giggling in between the songs? Was there any particular reason for that?
I think it's because it was quite an early show and it was probably quite shambolic.
Oh, okay.
And they were nervous, you know.
Emma said that she felt that she didn't know, think she could play her instruments and she didn't know what she was doing, and then suddenly she's in a band and she's got
Mickey
a label.
Was the same as well. Initially Meriel was the singer who was ended up being in the Pale Saints, and then she left and then Mickey had
that's,
to take
that's right yeah
she, and, and no, she wasn't a confident singer.
I saw this movie
Useful Noise.
Yes, one of the things that it talked about that scene was how and why it was so special, and I think it's a very short scene and I think it's hugely influential. Like, I don't think anything in England, independent-wise, it was called Indie Now, comes even close to that scene. I was so excited about music, and then Britpop came, and then I wasn't so excited.
Well, Britpop wasn't even indie, a lot of it. I mean, because most of the acts were on faux indie labels, which were owned by majors.
By majors, and they
I mean,
had
Britpop
the...
kind of killed the British music scene, really.
I never really liked a lot of the stuff,
because
and I
a lot of
so.
Because a lot of the groups just seemed as though they were doing it. Just fair enough, I know Oasis is ambitious and fair enough, and they're really successful, but a lot of other groups sort of just about ambition more than the music.
It's about to make fame, about to be like.
But being famous more than about them. You know, in the 80s, it was more about the music, you know.
And the Beautiful Noise was talking about how the girls were not worried about looking a particular way, like My Bloody Valentine's, like, I'll just turn up and you know, and it was a messy time. It was like Doc Martens with dresses and
well, that's what reminded me of post-punk, I say, it was in the same way that, you know, girls in bands in punk like the Slits or whatever,
mm-hmm.
It wasn't trying to be sexy
it wasn't image conscious
feminine, you know, it was just, you know, just being yourself. And also I guess also because the music wasn't rock, you know, it wasn't like
rock,
you know, it wasn't sort of heterosexual rock.
Yeah. The band changed direction, the album that you joined them on.
I just think the group became more confident, and especially vocally, Mickey, so the vocals weren't as submerged.
Yeah, that's because
as buried as they were initially, really.
Nikki said she always had this quieter and quieter. You know, the way they describe you guys as change, like maybe it was a feeling that the shoegaze was out and you guys were going more towards a Britpop sound.
Well, I'm sure we were influenced by the music around us, but I think we just wanted to capture more of our live sound, which was much more of a straightforward, and also we were more confident. You know, we'd played over 120 shows, live shows in 1992, so, you know, we got much better as a live band and we were much more confident.
Spooky. Actually, there was some criticism of Robin Guthrie's productions on that.
And it was the same, he produced a Felt album as well, Ignite the Seven Cannons, and he just, the Cocteau Twins, there's so many effects,
mm-hmm.
and chorus and everything, and that's his trademark.
Mm-hmm.
So he carried that through with Felt and also with Lush, so Lush couldn't help but sound quite like the Cocteau Twins, I think, with his production. He was more into the guitars and the sound of the guitars,
mm-hmm.
and not so much into, say, the sound of the drums.
Mm.
So the drums be quite buried.
Quite
as well.
Muted.
Yeah, quite
yeah.
muted.
And how did you feel... I mean, that's what the press said. How do you think the band felt about that themselves?
It was difficult for them because Robin wasn't getting on with... had fallen out with 4AD.
Uh-huh.
Because he and Liz recorded that version of The Song for a Siren for This Mortal Coil, and it was a cover version, and they just got paid musician union rates. And I don't think they were very happy about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it caused friction, so they ended up leaving 4AD. And that was the period where they were being produced, where Lush were being produced with them. So the Lush, I think they felt kind of caught in the middle of it, between 4AD and Robin, so that made things more difficult as well.
Right, yeah, and maybe the, and like, so when you go on to Split and the last LP, you think the drums came in? Oh, they did actually.
I think also, like, I mean, the drums on Spooky were recorded on like a Simmons kit, you know, one of those electronic kits.
Oh, okay.
So you could control it more.
Yeah.
Whereas Split and Spooky, I mean, everything was recorded. We would record it live in the room.
You got that pounding,
yeah,
thrusting.
We'd have the drums and the bass record. We'd record everything together, and then, of course, we would then replace guitars or whatever. But it would be recorded together as a live act, so it did sort of capture that. Whereas, I guess, Spooky didn't. But then I think it's got its own charm.
Spooky.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And
for not being that, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's why the shoegazing sound is still pop, because it kind of sounds timeless, really.
Yeah.
Because nothing else before sounded like that.
I think Ride had the same issue, you know, like they came on in the shoegaze wave, and then they're kind of like, well, I don't want to repeat this, I want to go somewhere new, and they kind of were influenced also by Britpop, and it might have caused a divide with some of their fans. This might have been the case with Lush. Do you feel like sometimes when you talk to the fans, do you feel like they, you know, is,
well,
there,
I think,
a divide?
They definitely don't. Because we had some chart success,
that
wasn't as cool. The Love Life albums wasn't as cool. I think in America maybe more than here, because it wasn't as alternative sounding, I guess, and it was poppier. Being on 4AD in some respects was great, in others it wasn't, because, you know, Split didn't do that well. If we'd been on a major label, we would probably been dropped after that album, but we weren't. And also we were given, you know, complete artistic freedom, which we probably wouldn't have had on a major label. But then again, when it came to that whole Britpop period, other groups who were on these faux indie labels that were really majors, you know, had the weight of the major record label to get them in the charts.
Mm.
So they would be a lot more
pressure,
a lot more successful.
Mm.
We'd get the top 20, they'd get in the top 10 or whatever, you know. But, you know, we always had artistic control, which was the most important thing. I think we had more pressure in America, really, because we were signed. Well, it was not so much Warner Brothers, actually. It was probably more our management. You know, especially we did Lollapalooza, you know, with Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and we were the opening act.
Yeah.
And it was more like, how can we capitalise on it, you know?
Yeah.
So there wasn't. And it was MTV 120 Minutes, so there was this kind of emphasis on
pow,
spending
boom,
lots of money, getting a MTV buzz bin.
Yeah, whatever, it's sensational.
Yeah.
Let's go, kids.
Yeah.
You know.
Because especially in America, you'd end up almost paying to play. You know, we'd have to borrow $30,000.
What? Why? You're supposed to be a tour.
To tour.
Jesus.
Because we'd have a tour bus. We'd stay in hotels. It'd be a 2 months tour. We'd have crew. We'd have to pay for lights. So you'd end up
not making any money.
Oh, God, no, you'd never make any money.
Right.
It was to promote the album.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're like just about maybe break even.
Oh, we wouldn't even do that.
You wouldn't even break even.
No.
You owed him money. Great. Yeah. I think it's kind of great that you did two different sounds, and it's nice that you actually. I mean, I listened to it. It's actually quite. You know, you're right. It's like this alternative thing when you're doing something probably more commercial, but it's actually done well. I personally like both sides. Do you feel that?
Well, I guess especially with Mickey and Emma's lyrics, they're always feisty, which is good because there's not many women writers.
Like, yeah, Lady Killer. I'm pretty
sure. Attitude, you know, sort of
writing
about things, issues, which, you know, not other female writers probably are writing about, you know. I don't know. Carly Simon, You're So Vain, maybe. I don't know.
It was a Lady Killer. I think I knew that guy in Camden. So you have this great success, and then this is tragedy strikes with Chris Eklund's suicide.
It's difficult because, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche. People say, you know, he was like the last person in the world that you'd expect to kill himself, really. I mean, he hit 30.
Mm-hmm.
He did sit, I mean, he was very gregarious, very outgoing, liked to enjoy himself on tour, was very friendly. So, I mean, he did go a little bit quieter on that tour. I just thought maybe he was hitting 30 and was, you know, reevaluating his life.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who kills himself, it seems unexplainable, really.
At this point, it's like the band is revitalized with this album.
I think we were all worn down by touring America, actually. Get Your Prayers Answered, like, we were having some chart success here, but we weren't really here enough to make the most of it, really. We seemed to be... Our management kept sending us back to America, and we ended up doing this tour with the Gin Blossoms, which was a bit of a disaster. We ended up playing...
Why was the Gin Blossoms?
Because there's a thing where we'd reached a plateau in terms of college radio.
Uh-huh.
So then it's, well, how do we get you to the next level?
Mm-hmm.
So they decided, oh, we should go out with the Gin Blossoms. They've got a different market, more commercial. So we did that, and that was... I mean, no disrespect back to them, they were nice, but it was playing to people who were at the cinema. You know, you'd look out and it'd be people with popcorn and a Coke, and it was like as though they were watching a film or something, because their album didn't do as well. So we ended up playing some venues, same size venues that we'd headlined months before.
But you were the support. I think that's in The Beautiful Noise, when you were going through, I think maybe Emma said something about this,
yeah.
We had been the headline.
I think both her and I got to the point where I think it was Toledo on a Saturday night, just thinking, what are we doing? You know, because there was always that, before that in America, you know, so many other English acts like Blur, whoever, would go out to America and hate it, you know.
But you loved it.
We loved it.
Yeah.
But that kind of, if you don't break America, it breaks you.
Yeah.
And it kind of broke us, really. We were put out on an unsuitable tour.
Right. I got you. Yeah.
And we were having a modicum of success in England, and we weren't there to, it felt, to reap the benefits of it.
Oh,
and Emma had enough, actually. I mean, she was going to leave. She decided she wanted to leave. I don't know. I mean, Chris did just, he went home to the Lake Districts. Yeah, that's when it happened.
And you, did he leave a note or something to explain what his,
so,
you know, his thoughts? And you yourself, do you think it was that disheartening tour that might have somehow at least had some kind of effect?
I don't know. Well, he did just
mind.
Start taking Prozac. So, I mean, you know, when someone kills yourself, you do try to sort of find a reason for it. I don't know whether that was part of the reason, because I know there's a small percentage of people who, when they take Prozac, you know, it does make them...
It doesn't do the effect.
It makes them suicidal. I don't know. I don't know. Who knows? I don't know. It's like a murder mystery where you know who the murderer is, but it doesn't really help, and it's still a mystery, you know, so...
That's eloquently put. After Chris had died, and obviously that's quite a blow to the band. How did you guys...
We didn't. That was it, and that was the end.
But did you... I've read that you continued a little bit afterwards.
No, we were meant to go out on a European tour. And I actually called Chris, because I'd heard from Mickey that he wasn't well enough to do it, or he wasn't going to do it. So I called him to find out, and that's when they just found him. So after that, that was it.
I guess
that's what happens to some group, isn't it? A bit of success actually destroys them, you know. Or a lot of success destroys them. Look at, I don't know, different level, of course. But, you know, Nirvana,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, you're underground for so long.
And then
you get success. Like, we know, we ended up doing lots of TV here. We did Richard and Judy, Top of the Pops. We did every music. Well, we did so many TV shows. And you enter this sort of really, this world of light entertainment. You know, especially coming from 4AD, where it was, you know, very arty and there's an aesthetic and it's cool. And then you enter this really cheesy world of light entertainment, and you just think, oh my God, what are we doing here? Simon Mayo in a fat suit dancing while we're miming to Single Girl. You know,
it's
like the last days of vaudeville or something.
Oh God!
It's kind of like answers. Yeah, they're saying answer prayers. Like, did I really want this?
Another musical interlude there, that was the lovely and the ethereal side of Lush. From 1994, the track title was Lit Up. Now, here's a good place to plug my partner in crime, Ambient Airwaves. Purveyors and promoters of shoegaze, noise, psych, and space rock. They have a YouTube, Last.fm, Pandora, and Facebook featuring some of the best tunage in this area of music. Just search Ambient Airwaves at any of those sites, and ye shall find musical treasures of such delights. Now let's return to our final chapter with my chat with Phil King and his adventures with the Jesus and Mary Chain. The first time you were asked to join the Jesus and Mary Chain, you turned it down, and part of the reason you turned it down was because you'd become disillusioned with the music business. And after having heard what you just said to me there, I'm wondering, is that, or is there something else?
No, that's true. I'd actually gone back to working at the NME. I think I was doing the gig guide then, or pictures, and they contacted me, and I just kind of thought, do I want to go back to the music business? Then I just thought, oh, come on, don't miss the Jesus and Mary Chain. I'd actually auditioned for the Jesus and Mary Chain I never auditioned. I have to go back on what I said before. I auditioned for the Jesus and Mary Chain about 1990. So and I just thought, oh, come on, I'd always loved the Jesus and Mary Chain. So I agreed to do it.
You weren't on Monkey?
No, they recorded Monkey, they'd finished it about a year before in their own studio in Elephant Castle in the drugstore. And I don't think Blanco wanted to put it out, Blanco Negro. They went back on Creation, full circle.
Well, let's just talk about the sound, because you auditioned for the Jesus and Mary Chain, and I'm sure you're aware that they were influenced by the Sex Pistols, or that was a major influence, and they're kind of like our 80s Velvet Underground also. Dark, dirty sound.
They're very confrontational.
Yes, they're very confrontational, and obviously they took that, I think they must have taken that from the Sex Pistols a bit, you know, the punk rock attitude, but the sound is...
Also, they were influenced by a lesser known group, Dr. Mix and the Remix, which was a group after Metal Urbain. They were French.
Oh, I know Metal Urbain. Panic?
Panic, yeah.
Yeah.
The main guy ended up performing Dr. Mix and the Remix.
Oh, okay. So
they were quite influenced by that.
By French punk.
Yeah.
As well as the Sex Pistols. Fantastic.
And also, I think, as they said, you know, taking the sound of Sonic Youth, but mixing with the Shangri-Las, you know. Poppier. And, you know, playing Psycho Candy recently, and you put it on, and it still doesn't sound like a tame record. You know, lots of records, 20 years later, you listen to them, that might have been edgy at the time, and the edges have been smoothed off, but that certainly hasn't, you know. But you can still hear the melodies underneath, you know. I auditioned with them in 91. I didn't get it. Was it 1991? Because...
It's not the hair.
No, not the hair this time, actually, the shoes.
No, I was kidding.
The shoes. Well, Jim says that it was between me and Ben who ended up getting it.
Mm-hmm.
He says that they flipped a coin and I lost the toss. William says I didn't get it because my shoes were too pointy. When I joined in 98, basically, I just turned up and I'd learnt a few songs, and they just said, oh, you know, the song's better than us. Let's just, after about 20 minutes, let's go to the pub. So there was a lot of time spent in the pub.
This is dark, dirty rock. Maybe rock is
well, that's
word.
The thing. Well, I don't know. I think it is fair to call them they are rock. Gnarly,
yeah, but there's like a...
I mean, it's not like an indie tweeness.
No, there's no tweeness at all, but...
Where a lot of indie or independent is very English, with a Mary Chain, you know, there's lots of iconic American imagery, you know, the stars and stripes and the bikes and the leather and the biker boots and... Maybe that's why Automatic didn't do so well here, because that was like their American album, you know, Coast to Coast, and or even later, you know, Die Like JFK, you know. But it's like an observer's, it's us being English growing up on watching American TV. It's like a observational look at America rather than an America.
A real American perspective. Yeah. You joined in here at the last leg of in the 90s with them, and what we have here is something I find quite classically present. Two brothers in a band who have this antagonistic relationship, like Gene loves Jezebel, Oasis, Kinks, And you've joined in on that.
I mean, it had got worse, but I didn't know that. I just walked into it and there was lots of antagonism. Well, I'd read about the Jesus and Mary chain. I knew it was antagonistic, so it's kind of what I expected, really. It wasn't like, for them, it was, which had been a gradual progression of the antagonism getting worse. So for me, I kind of expected
You knew what you were walking into.
I knew what I was walking into.
Do you think it had a positive impact on their creativity at all?
Yeah, definitely.
And how would you say
that? Well, especially being two brothers, yeah, they're antagonistic, but also that was their strength against the music industry, I think, because they could, they were like-minded in their vision. Because there's two of them, they could stand stronger against
whatever sort of,
you know,
came their way.
Whatever came their way from, you know, music record labels saying, why don't you do this? And they'll just say no, you know, solo or a singer, a songwriter in a group on his own, you know, is much easier to pick off. And of course the antagonism fed into the music.
It added the edge.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this, like, part of the, when they recorded Monkey, and maybe Jim says that album was like a divide.
They recorded all the songs separately.
You know, because I Hate Rock and Roll was written, like you said, disillusionment with the music industry. But, you know, Jim kind of felt that it was only half.
Well, Jim was obviously, wasn't writing about the industry. He was writing about the music.
About the music. And like,
well, I do remember we used to go, there was a pub across the road. We spent more time in the pub than in the studio rehearsing. And I remember them having an argument one day, William saying, why did you write a song called, I wrote a song called I Hate Rock and Roll. Why did you have to write a song called I Love Rock and Roll? Yeah.
What did Jim say to that?
Well, you know, because it's for his love of rock and roll, for music. It wasn't... Obviously, William wasn't talking about the music.
He was talking about the industry.
Whereas Jim was talking about
just
the music. And which kind of makes it whole, doesn't it, really? Creates a balance between the two.
Yeah, he said it was... He thought it was...
Yin and yang, rock and roll.
You know, so let's talk about that final gig, because it kind of blew off on the tour, or the last gig.
Well, it kind of went off the day before, coming back from San Diego. There was a bit of a fight. Yeah, we played a show, and let's say Jim wasn't in the best of condition.
Mm-hmm.
Every song just collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that for about 15 minutes, and I think the drummer, Nick, and I just looked at each other, and we just downed tools, and then we just all walked off. I think I've said before, the worst thing, though, is we got off stage and we wanted a drink, and they'd locked the fridge with the drinks in it.
Oh, no. Oh, so. Jesus Christ.
And then afterwards, I went to a friend of mine was there and said, do you want to go to Eddie Izzard's having a party on the rooftop of the Hyatt, you know, where the swimming pool is?
Yeah.
So we went up there, and it was just so bizarre, because it was just sort of an oasis of calm and very loved, you know, actors and... with the cocktails, and I sort of went over to the edge and I looked down at this sort of angry and confused crowd milling around outside the House of Blues from the Jesus and Mary Chain gig. It was like two different worlds.
What do you think was the main contention, just bare bones contention between them?
They just needed a break, really. They just spent too much time together. They'd been together.
How did you feel when that happened and when it just kind of collapsed?
Oh my god. And the next night I thought, oh, at least it's all over now, but we had to finish the tour. So the next night we played in a supper club in San Juan Capistrano.
A supper club,
and we had William's amp set up just in case. We didn't know if he was going to come back or not. And then we couldn't do, because he sang I Hate Rock and Roll and he sang Cracking Up. So we had to drop those from the set. So we did the set without them. We came off stage and they said, well, you know, you're contracted to play this amount of time and you're about 15 minutes short.
Oh.
So we had to go on and we had to do Reverence for about 15 minutes.
Oh.
Just to sort of... And we were playing to this audience who were...
Eating their dinner. Okay, I'm sorry. Who booked the supper club? And don't you think that is just like
our agent?
I wish I could have seen it, because you guys must have been like...
It was quite funny.
I can imagine it was quite funny. Like I said, the Sex Pistols at the rodeo club, yeah. Did you say? Or, you know.
And then after that, it went from bad to worse, because Nick, our drummer, ended up dislocating his shoulder in Texas. And then we had to use the drummer from Mercury Rare, who had never played with us. And he did really well.
Uh-huh.
And then the last show on the tour in Portland was cancelled because the promoter ran away or absconded. And then
some
of the band and crew almost got into a fight with the cast of Riverdance.
Just have this vision of the Jesus and Mary Jane fighting with the cast of Riverdance.
And they could have whipped our asses. Yeah, the last ever show, Mary Chain show, was Thessalonica in Greece, and that was it. That was 1998, and then we didn't come back till 2007.
Let's move on to 2007 then.
Jim Reed was doing shows, so I was playing guitar with him, and there was an agent in America who were trying to get some shows through, and he just kept pushing, why don't the Mary Chain reform? Why don't the Mary Chain reform? And I didn't think they ever would. In fact, I was still have a day job at Uncut, a music magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out about it by someone at work telling me, oh, I see the Mary Chain are playing Coachella. So.
How did they manage to finally heal these wounds to bring them together?
I guess they both sort of had a time to ponder and realise how important the Jesus and Mary Chain is and was to them. And how stupid it was that they split up.
I mean, this is the primal. Obviously, Bobby Gillespie was with the band, there was this, like you said, there was this Scottish connection or Scottish experience, permeating through some of the important Creation Records bands.
Well, of course, also there was the influence of the early '80s Orange Juice and the postcard scene as well.
You said the brothers had different personalities. How would you characterise them?
They're both insular, but I'd say William is probably more outgoing than Jim. Jim's, as he would say himself, is quite sharp. Well, even now, he's just started using these in-ears. Just headphones, little moulded headphones put in your ear so you can hear yourself sing. Before, you'd have a monitor, so he was kind of... And now he's got those, it's just given him so much more, even after all these years, much more confidence singing, so he's never felt that confident on stage. Because, he's got a great voice, but it's not like Robert Plant, loud. He's got a quiet voice,
mm-hmm.
but a cool voice, cool rock and roll
cool
voice.
Cool voice, yeah.
But, all the time, he'd been fighting against the guitars, these loud guitars and drums, so...
I mean, they were influenced by the Sex Pistols. But do you think part of that confrontation...
With attitude, yeah.
But do you think the attitude in the confrontation is sort of like a reaction against the shyness?
I think so. The shyness might come across as being taciturn or,
Like completely I don't care.
Being cool or...
Yeah.
Just more feeling awkward. Well, that's why it's great if you're shy being in a group. Because it's very controlled when you're on stage.
You can really...
You know what's going to happen. Although saying that, being in the Jesus and Mary Chain...
You might not know what's going to happen.
Well, the worst has happened numerous times, splitting up on stage.
Yeah.
Or Jim's favourite. He doesn't do it anymore, actually. If he couldn't hear himself, he would go, stop. The song would come to a crashing halt and he'd have to start again. So that's probably most musicians' worst nightmare. So it's happened. So I'm quite relaxed on stage now because the worst has happened. So
we have the first single. This is was it from 2007?
All Things Must Pass is a song that we recorded in 2007, 2008 for Heroes.
Yeah, and that was like the first release.
It did come out. It was pressed up as a sort of single that was sold at shows. I don't think it actually came out officially, but it was the...
So it's an older song, but it was the first release in a long time.
Yeah, it was actually quite a new song.
It is a new song,
yeah. Very soon, next week. Going into the studio to record some new material with Youth from Killing Joke, who's produced...
Wow.
The Verve and, lots of people, lots of...
Lots of important
musicians. So that's cool.
The reunion. I mean, you have the single, the new album's coming out. This is so fantastic. This is so exciting. And all these people have been waiting for quite a long time for this reunion. And the last gig in London, there was so... much excitement. I mean, I didn't get a chance to go, but it was so much excitement.
Well, especially doing the Psycho Candy album. It's been exciting to play. I mean, I bought that album the week it came out. So, you know, it's exciting for me to play it. I mean, some of the songs they've never played live, and some of the songs they feel that, especially towards the end of the album, that, you know, they sound better live than they ever did on record. So,
do they feel the love coming from the fans? Do they realize?
They really hate being complimented.
I know, so it's kind of, so I can't, you know, but do you think on some level they appreciate it? Even if they can't do a compliment.
Jim tends, they'll sign stuff for fans, and yeah, I think so. But yeah, they do, they're very wary of people complimenting. The first show that I played on guitar, where we got the Shinai pedal out, was in Primavera in Barcelona a couple of years ago, and I always remember at the set we did a rehearsal. I was playing the pedal, and we're trying to get William to play the pedal. And initially, he didn't want to play it, and I said to him, "Oh, come on, William, you've got to play the pedal. You've got to do it because that's what the fans want." And he said to me, which is so true, he said, "When have we ever done what the fans wanted?" And it just sums them up, their perverseness.
A kind of warm, dark perverseness. Thank you so much, Phil King, for talking to me now about all these amazing bands that you've been with.
My pleasure.
Okay, that was the end of my chat with Phil King. And that was such a brilliant little slice of musical history there. That was just fabulous. Now, The Cool Kitchen is nearly done, but stay tuned because I've got one more song left. And if you're listening to Primal Radio, Indie 500 is on straight after me, and I'm sure you're going to want to check that out. If you enjoyed this look at some early creation records, bands and stuff, and indie music history of the 80s and 90s, you can contact me. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Ello, Tumblr, and Google+, and MySpace. Or if you'd like to hear more of my shows, I've got podcasts on Mixcloud, Heart This, Spreaker, and Stitcher. You can follow me on any of those for the podcasts. And if you'd like to communicate or listen to me on any of those sites, just search Ola's Cool Kitchen. You've been listening to The Cool Kitchen on Rock Access Radio, Magic Monster Radio, KCLA 99.3 FM in Los Angeles, DCRC Radio 1, 107.5 and Howe.fm in New Zealand, and Primal Radio and the Indie Authority. Thank you so much for tuning in. Now, this is their latest release, which was from 2007 from the Jesus and Mary Chain, and the song is All Things Must Pass.